So I want to thank the organizing committee for organizing this nice conference at this nice place. And I'm going to talk about some work which I've done together with my former student, Johannes Tamburino, and here are some references. and the motivation for this work is that we are trying to construct a background-independent quantum gravity, background-independent theory of quantum gravity. And one difficulty in doing so is that we have to use gauge-invariant observables. So gauge-invariant here means invariant under diffeomorphisms, and it's unclear how, for instance, to express local quantities in a diffeomorphism-invariant way. And the other way is that the other reason is that it's usually complicated to obtain these observables because basically one has to solve the equation of motions and gravity is a very complicated theory. So one can do two kinds of approximations. Namely, one would be to consider in a kind of large scale limit a mini superspace approximation. And being a large scale limit, the observables one has there are very global, and for that reason it's very difficult to get predictions which can be really measured in a local way. And the other approximation one can think of is the perturbation around some fixed background. So that would be basically quantum fields on curved space-time. And there we work with local fields, but for gravity there arises the gauge problem, which is known from cosmology basically, to differentiate really between physical effects and effects which are just because of one has chosen a certain gauge. So furthermore, one knows that somehow these two limits get corrections from each other, basically. There's one way that we know basically here, one can understand the background as coming from this mini superspace approximation. However, we know that this side has to be quantized, so somehow one would expect that there are some effects coming from the quantization of the background. On the other side, we know that the perturbations have somehow to backreact on this mini superspace approximation onto the global observables. So basically, this approach here will be to really start from the gauge-invariant observables and try to reconsider these two limits. And see whether we can also automatically get these kind of corrections. And one question which we are going to answer is, for instance, what are the gauge-invariant observables which reduce to the local quantum field observables? So here I'm just in the classical formalism, so just field observables, but that would be, will have applications to quantum field theory. And the result is that it results in a gauge-invariant Hamiltonian framework for cosmological perturbations to arbitrary high order, and here I'm explaining some of these properties of this framework. So we are considering perturbations around the symmetry reduced sectors of GR. So for instance, about a sector which describes really homogeneous solutions, therefore cosmology, and we are trying to do it in a gauge-invariant way, which will ensure that the results don't depend on the choice of gauge, which is important for some discussions which are going on, for instance, in cosmology about the backreaction effects, where there is the question whether these are dependent on the gauge or not. And it would also allow characterization of symmetric physical states, so that the states which really satisfy, for instance, the diffeomorphism constraints, but which should also be at the same time describe homogeneous solutions. So this framework works to arbitrary high order. So one can describe for instance backreaction and scattering with this framework. And since it works beyond linear order, one is ensured that one can embed the results in the full theory. It's canonical because we are interested in quantization, and it makes straightforward to answer, for instance, questions about the commutator algebra of these observables, because we just have to calculate the Poisson brackets. And that's one application I hope to manage to show here, that we can consider the locality properties of these observables. And another feature is that the background is fully, or the background variables are fully dynamical. And in this framework, it's necessary because these background variables, you need these background variables to define a physical time parameter. And it makes straightforward the discussion of back reaction effects. So one, as you will see, we do not really perturb around a fixed background metric, but around a phase space sector describing configurations with high symmetry. So the overview is that first I will introduce what the perturbations are, then I will introduce the concept of complete observables. So these are the observables we are going to approximate, so these Gage-Invariant observables. Then I will explain perturbative complete observables, so that is putting one and two together. And as an application, I will discuss locality properties of these observables and finish with an outlook and a conclusion. So these perturbations are defined by basically taking the phase space and dividing it in two sets of variables, and this is done by introducing a projection operator acting on the space of phase space function. And in the case of cosmology, this projection operator is just taking the average of a phase space function, of some basic set of phase space function, which in this case are given by the canonical variables. So I just have written one example here, which is to take the triad and average it over the hypersurface. And so that would be the result of applying the projection operator. And the rest of the functions are the inhomogeneities, so that would be the difference of the real triad with the average triad. So that's the idea. And so this would describe cosmology, but one can also describe perturbations around a fixed background in this framework by just defining the projection operator to be the evaluation on a background phase space point. So as an example here, I just define the projection acting on this triad to be the Konica delta, and the perturbations are just the difference of the real triad with the Konica delta. So the subdivision, the examples I've given here are in a certain way consistent with the symplectic or kinematical structure, and there is a certain requirement which ensures on the projection operator which ensures that it's consistent with the symplectic structure. And here, the important point is that the homogeneous variables arise really through averaging from the full phase space. And so I can really calculate back the full phase space variables from the homogeneous variables and from the inhomogeneous variables. And they are fully dynamical, and as I already mentioned, they provide global clocks and are important for the invariants to higher order. And this fully dynamical is one of the key differences with the standard perturbative approach. So, and here I defined basically the order, the different orders I'm going to count in the perturbations. So I define the homogeneous variables, so these are the average connection and the average triad, to be of zeroth order. And the inhomogeneous canonical variables, typically notified by small letters, are first order variables. I don't have any higher order variables because I just need this first order and zeroth order to calculate back my full phase space variables. But higher order terms are just the polynomials of first order variables and zeroth order variables to the appropriate order. So I can count orders now. And we are going just to calculate these Gage-Invariant observables and expand them to a certain order. And the question is, how do we compute these? So, and we are taking here the concept of complete observables, which was introduced by Carlo Rovelli and expanded by myself. And they can be understood as follows. So we are in the canonical formalism, which means that we have given some phase-space variables, which are just initial data on some initial data hypersurface sigma. And one can understand that these initial data in the following way. They've given a solution of the equation of motion, and then we can just choose a certain hypersurface here, and then the solution of equation of motion will just induce some kind of initial data on my hypersurface. And the gauge transformation which arise in this initial, in the canonical formalism are that I just change this initial data hypersurface in a certain way, so I make a small bump, for instance, here. And this will induce me a different set of initial data. But these two initial data sets are equivalent, are gauge equivalent. So gauge invariant variables in the canonical formalism means functions of the phase space variables which are invariant under this deformation of the initial data hypersurface. And these complete observables are constructed in the following way. So I have to specify a set of clocks, T. So these are phase space functions. And setting them equal to some parameters will specify the position and shape of a hypersurface by this equation T equal to tau. So this could be, for instance, this hypersurface, which could be far away from this initial data hypersurface. And then I can define the following quantity, namely f of t in square brackets, and that should give me the value of the phase space function f on this hypersurface. So basically I have to take the initial data here, find the hypersurface on which t is equal to tau, and take my phase space function f and evaluate it on this hypersurface. And this phase space function is invariant under the deformation done on this hypersurface, because still if I'm doing the calculation in the correct way, if I introduce a bump here, it shouldn't affect my end result, namely what is the value of the phase space function f here on this hypersurface, which is fixed by a physical requirement, namely that the t should be equal to the parameters tau. So f of tau is really a gauge invariant phase space function. And now the question is how to compute the complete observables. And the difficulty which was there for a long time was that the algebra of the gauge generators in general relativity was quite complicated. However, it turns out that for the purpose of these calculations, one can just use another basis of gauge generators, which I call clock-adapted gauge generators, C tilde K. And they are clock-adapted because basically they evolve the clocks in a very simple way, namely in a linear way. And they are weakly, so they generate, the gauge flows are on the constrained hypersurface are abelian, so I call it weakly abelian constraints. And this weakly abelianness allows you to just expand this complete observables in a kind of power series, and basically these would be the difference between the points where I'm R at the moment, so that would be T, indicated by T, and where I want to get to, namely tau. So these are just, this looks very similar to the usual time evolution expansion, and it's so because we can just use these weakly abelian constraints. And the idea is now to take this power series expansion and then expand it again, order by order, so we have to reorder some terms, and this will result in a gauge invariant observable of order m. So the precise meaning of that is that this truncated gauge invariant, this truncated complete observable commutes with the constraints up to terms of order m plus 1. And it turns out that one can make easily contact with standard perturbation theory, because the terms can be interpreted as just free propagation or propagation on the background, as interaction terms, and as gauge invariant extension terms. Okay. So this however works only if the clocks satisfy certain properties. So here I have to choose a set of first order clocks. And these first order clocks describe basically the shape of the hypersurface, so how the hypersurface wiggles around. And they are all set to zero. And as an example, one can choose longitudinal clocks, which are not really intuitive accessible, but these are just given by some mode decomposition of the connection here. And here we have the inverse Laplace operator, so which means that these are quite non-local, because basically they define the hypersurface in a non-local way by making it quite smooth, for instance. As another example, one can use scalar fields as clocks, and in this case gives really a local description of the hypersurface, because basically in this case the hypersurface can be understood as being described as the hypersurface where a certain scalar field is just constant. And one has another global clock which is of zeroth order, so it doesn't have a first order term, and this describes the position of the hypersurface in my spacetime manifold and therefore provides a global time parameter. So as an example, can either take the volume of my hypersurface or the average scalar field. So I take now this power series for my complete observables, and I just reorder the terms, and so the result is that, for instance, for a first-order variable function, for a first-order function f, I take a term which just describes free propagation, that means propagation on the background. Then in gauge invariant extension term of this free propagation term, then something which is just the interaction terms, so which is of second order, and the gauge invariant extension of the interaction term. So this gauge invariant extension, I didn't wrote it here because it's a bit longer, but basically it's the same structure as here, and it's can be iteratively built from this kind of terms. So this can be extended to any order, and it shows that we can compute gauge invariant observables order by order, and that these observables also encode local information, because I can just start from a phase space function which gives me the field at one point, and the full gauge invariant observable will reduce to this phase space function in the limit of going to a fixed background. And moreover, time evolution with respect to a physical clock can also be implemented perturbatively in this framework. So as an example, I will shortly describe the locality properties of these observables. And interestingly, these really depend on the choice of clocks you made. So as an example, one can take scalar fields as clocks, and there one can show that if these Fs are scalar fields on my manifold, then these observables associated to the scalar fields will commute if the parameters describe me two space-time points which are space-like related. And that is true to all orders. On the other hand, if I describe basically look at the commutator between two nearby scalar fields, that is basically I go to the no gravity limit, I get the usual result, namely just the Green's function, but I get a correction. And this goes as energy of the scalar field I'm considering divided by the energy of the clocks. Now this energy of the 1 over energy of the clock goes to 0, of course, if I make this energy of the clocks very large. But the problem is that at some point I will get back reaction of the clock. So one cannot make it arbitrarily large. And this factor could be interpreted as some fundamental resolution limit for these observables. And the question is, does it appear also for the other choice of clocks one can make in this framework, namely for instance for the longitudinal clocks? And here the analogous result would be that the field variables associated to space-like related points commute, however, only up to second order. So if these would be second order, the second order gauge invariant observables, to higher order one will get very non-local terms given by because of the inverse Laplacian, which appears in the clocks. However, in the no gravity limit, I just get back the usual result because these observables just reduce to the usual field observables on a fixed background. So I just get the Green's function here. One doesn't see this factor for this clock. So this describes a non-local measurement, but it's completely local in the flat space limit to second order. So I can arrive this conclusion. So the central object of the perturbative scheme here are observables, and then we just divide phase space into homogeneous and inhomogeneous variables, but keep both completely dynamical. And this gives the first order canonical formalism for cosmological perturbations to any order. And now it's possible to do explicit calculations of second order gauge invariants. And as Johannes will show, one can discuss back reaction effects. So as an outlook, one can extend these perturbations around to perturbations around Mealy superspaces, that is spherical symmetric spacetimes, and consider the question that one can embed approximations into each other, which would allow you to make conclusions about what could be possible non-perturbative effects. This allows for a characterization of physical symmetric states because one is really working with observables. And yeah, this is that altering, one can try in a kind of effective approach as done by Martin, try to alter the constraint. And here it will ensure you that you get, in a sense, a consistent set of equations of motion. So, for your attention.
So, I'm slightly confused because I don't know what has been done and whether some application has been performed with this analysis. So, like, have you tried to do some analysis with scalar or tensor perturbations?
Yeah, we.
The results come out from the same as what we understand.
Yeah, one can, so we derive the equation of motion to linear order for tensor modes and for scalar modes, and they are exactly, if you know that, so these are basically the equation of motion for the gauge invariant extensions to first order of the scalar modes, for instance, and they are the same as in the gauge fixed approach. So one gets really one-to-one correspondence with a small difference that in our case, one has to specify a global time parameter, a global physical clock, but which you should do anyway. I mean, it's so given by, I don't know, the temperature of your microwave background or something like that.
But the results could depend on how you choose this time parameter.
Yeah, but the equation of motion for instance, for the scalar modes, I mean, they also, you could write them down for arbitrary laps. And specifying these clocks just means that you specify the laps. And before the step of specifying the zeroth order laps, basically, it's the same. So, yeah.
I have a question. Do you think, how does the, is there a notion of physical Hamiltonian?
Yeah, there is a notion. So, for the case that, the clock variables Poisson commute, there is a notion to arbitrary order. So for the scalar field, it would be just the momentum conjugated to the scalar field, which you can re-express into the other variables by using the constraints. And for the longitudinal clocks, you get a physical Hamiltonian to second order. However, interestingly, the clocks for the longitudinal modes don't commute. So, to me it's unclear how to define the physical Hamiltonian to higher order just because the clocks don't commute for the longitudinal modes.
But scalar field clock, how do you take almost any solution of Einstein equation for the scalar field? It's almost never the case that the scalar field gradient of the scalar field is time-like.
Yeah. So it's a perturbative approach. So here you would perturb around a certain sector, around which the scalar fields give you a good clocks, which is also done by in standard cosmological perturbation theory.
But then the Poisson is stated in the distant numbers. That wasn't true in zero order or something like that.
One can define this physical Hamiltonian, then the other question would be whether the Hamiltonian is positive definite or something like that.
No, but you get the Poisson bracket to be zero in a tensor, and that must be true with the zero at all or something.
The Poisson bracket with the physical Hamiltonian or?
F of t
prime?
T prime. Because of the time itself is really only the zero at all, it's not the good bracket of the Poisson.
Yes, so of course if you go to a sector where all your scalar fields are constant, that doesn't make sense, which is an important question. But if you are in a sector which defines your good clocks, then it's true to any order.
So can you please clarify, like, what do you mean by when you say that you do dynamics perpetually? Like, I'm choosing a slightly different clock, or?
Can you repeat this question? Better I look at each slide.
I think, like, some of the slides you said, and even now you said that these clocks.
Can you speak up?
Like, the result is that the way you do the dynamics, or you just like the evolution of the automations, that is perturbative. So, you're perturbing over the background, that's
my thing. Yeah, around the sector of phase space.
Is there any other assumption? Is there any other assumption which goes in?
Yeah, basically, you have to choose a global clock, which would describe you really the position of phase of your hypersurface you are asking question to. And this global clock has to give you a good time parameter. So in the mini superspace should be a function which should be monotonic in time. In general, I agree. It's not straightforward to do, but I mean, if you have an inflationary open model, you can take the volume of your hypersurface. If you have closed models, you shouldn't really do that.
So for the inflationary model, you take volume of hypersurface as your
problem? Yeah, for instance. I mean, so, I mean, there are explicit transformations between different clocks, so if you are in a regime where the clock fails to be a good clock, you could change your clock.
I think we should move on and thank Bianca again.